This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's theme is Lyme disease. Lyme disease, of course, in the summer, is something that really tends to explode. You know, I was thinking, the two escapees, the two prisoners who were tramping out in the woods in upstate New York, that if they hadn't been apprehended by the police, that they most likely would have been apprehended by the ticks prevalent in the woods. I sort of felt sorry for them because, well, a little bit sorry for them. They were both murderers, and I guess they got their just desserts. But I thought that nature would inflict a cruel punishment on them from, you know, just tramping through the woods cross country without any bug spray, without any protection. Ultimately, we'll see if the surviving prisoner succumbs to his wounds or succumbs to Lyme disease. That's the theme of today's program. And today we're going to talk to what I consider a real eminent authority on the subject of Lyme disease. He's been a frequent guest here on Intelligent Medicine and on the predecessor program, Health Talk. He's my good colleague, Dr. Leo Galland. Dr. Galland has been there with very, very early adoption of some key concepts in integrative medicine. He's been practicing for over 30 years. He's been a mentor to me, reading his writings and listening to his lectures. He was one of the first to really be onto the key importance of essential fatty acids. He was recognized the importance of dysbiosis and candida and the importance of the microbiome. He recognized the importance of key nutrients like magnesium, writing extensively on that subject well before it was generally recognized that this was important. So today we turn to him for his take on Lyme disease, which has been a recent focus of his practice. He's written several books. He's written Super Immunity for Kids, Power Healing, he has an excellent website, pilladvised.com. Is that correct, Leo?
That's it, Ron.
Okay. So he received his education at Harvard University, New York University School of Medicine, and trained at NYU Bellevue Medical Center a couple of years before I was there. And he's received numerous accolades, including the prestigious Linus Pauling Award from the Institute of Functional Medicine. So without further ado, here's Dr. Galland. It's a pleasure having you as a guest once again, Leo.
Well, Ron, it's always great to be speaking with you, and going over topics that are really important for people to know out there. On the topic of Lyme disease, by the way, I would say that the risk of getting Lyme disease is probably greater in the suburbs than in the northern Adirondacks, because because of the ecology of deer ticks, the animals that transmit them, and you probably have the greatest risk if you're in situations where there are small packets of green near homes that people live in. Because then you have an absence of predators. Up in the Adirondacks, there are predators who manage to keep control over the smaller rodents that are so efficient at bringing deer ticks close to you. And the data indicates that it's mice more so than deer that are the most important reservoir for deer ticks in terms of the transmission of Lyme disease to humans.
Well, so this could be looked at almost as a kind of a suburban phenomenon, the suburbanization or the expansion of the suburbs. And everybody wants their piece of green. They want, you know, to be next to a golf course or next to a nice wooden glade. And that may be part and parcel of why this epidemic seems to be exploding.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, because there's a change in the kinds of animals, the kinds of mammals that inhabit the green belts in suburban areas compared to just, you know, a primary forest. And those animals are more susceptible to, more likely to carry deer ticks, and more likely to bring them into contact with humans. I mean, mice just come into your yard, into your home.
Well, so you have sort of a cachet here in New York City, and really across the country, given patients who are, you know, from all over America and throughout the world, who come to you with very complex and challenging medical problems. How was it that you got particularly focused on Lyme disease as an important issue?
Well, but basically because it was something that patients brought to me. I mean, what I've basically been doing for the past 35 years is people come to me with problems. Sometimes they're really complicated. Usually they're problems that they've seen other doctors for and haven't gotten solutions. And so I try to figure out, okay, what's important for these individuals? And then I study it and I begin to find patterns that are relevant. And that's the way it went with Lyme disease. It on any given day, 30 to 50% of the patients that I see have Lyme disease or some other tick-borne illness. And I think it's in part because it's increasing and because the people that are getting sick with Lyme disease are not getting answers. They Lyme is a great masquerader. So either they're being given a diagnosis, but the real cause of what's going on, what underlies their diagnosis, is Lyme disease or one of the other tick-borne infections. And this is especially true for neurologic disorders and autoimmune disorders that don't have any other known cause. Or they've been treated for Lyme disease, but they haven't really gotten better, or they haven't stayed better because of the characteristics of the infection and what's required for people to get cured.
Well, as you know, I mean, there's a tremendous controversy over Lyme disease. On the one hand, there are some real Lyme disease traditionalists in the infectious disease community who say, look, there's Lyme disease where, you know, it's pretty obvious, and you take antibiotics, you get the bullseye rash, you get arthritis, you get fever, and then you get treated. And then there are the people who don't seem to get better, but they say that the reason they don't get better is that their Lyme disease has been adequately treated. It's just what's called post-Lyme disease. It's the aftermath of Lyme, and they feel there's no justification for long-term antibiotic use or even intravenous antibiotic use or other methods to eradicate this organism. So what say ye about that?
Okay, well, first of all, it's very clear, and I think everybody agrees, that about 25% of people who have been treated for Lyme disease continue to have symptoms after their treatment. And the best way to describe that would be post-treatment Lyme symptoms. And then the question is, well, what is the cause of post-treatment Lyme symptoms? And there are several possibilities. And I think what's really important for individuals who have post-treatment Lyme symptoms is that they see doctors who understand that there are several possibilities, that it's not the same thing for everybody. There are, in fact, people who have persistent infection. And I'd like to say more about that because it's important. It's not really well understood, but it is an area that is being studied by really prominent researchers, Johns Hopkins, Stanford, Northeastern University, are all places that are studying this phenomenon of persistent Lyme symptoms, of persistent infection after what should have been adequate treatment. The second possibility is that they've developed an autoimmune disease which was triggered by having Lyme disease.
And we actually have some models of this in, you know, with other types of conditions.
Yeah, sure.
Where certain, you know, it's even thought that maybe some people with multiple sclerosis, they got some kind of virus, maybe it's Epstein-Barr virus, something else, that may have triggered an inflammatory response, and the virus actually has calmed down, but the condition persists.
Right. Yeah, there are many examples of an infectious process stimulating an autoimmune disease that... And in a lot of those cases, sometimes if you treat the infection, the autoimmune disease calms down, and sometimes it doesn't because it just has a life of its own. And in the case of Lyme disease, this has been very well established both for arthritis and for neurologic disorders, you know, like peripheral painful neuropathies, for example. And there are specific treatments that can be helpful for those conditions. Then the third possibility, it has been best studied in animals, but I mean it's been proven in laboratory mice and rats, that even though the infection itself is gone, there's debris from the infection that is still present in the tissues and that is provoking an inflammatory reaction. This is not exactly an autoimmune disorder, but it's close to it. It might fit into that category. And it's similar to conditions that have been described with other kinds of infection that are caused called reactive arthritis. There are people who, after GI infections or sexually transmitted disorders, will have arthritis, and it's due to the debris from the bacteria that are causing persistent ongoing inflammation.
Could that possibly explain what a lot of patients report, which is when they get treated, they get worse before they get better. They get what's called a Herxheimer or a die-off reaction.
It may be related to that. In fact, I've seen, on the autoimmune front, I've seen people who started out with no neurologic symptoms, only joint pain, for example, and after receiving antibiotics, began to develop neurologic symptoms. And I think the die-off reaction is actually what's triggering the autoimmunity in those cases. Because following those patients for a while and working, the joint problems go away. But the neurologic problems persist and take on a life of their own.
So how do you know? That's the key question, is how do you know where you're at with a patient, whether they've been adequately treated, whether they've been inadequately treated, whether it's persistent Lyme disease or the autoimmune thing. I think that's really the conundrum.
Right. It's not easy. And let me just kind of finish out the discussion.
Sure.
There is a fourth possibility, which is the main place that's been studying this is at Columbia University at the Lyme Treatment Center, which is a kind of neural sensitization. That is, it's the belief of the researchers there that Lyme disease produces damage to the nervous system that then creates chronic pain and other symptoms that are due to neurologic hypersensitivity.
It's kind of like irritable bowel syndrome of the brain.
Yeah, actually, yes. Yes, it is. I would say the other... there are a couple of other possibilities as well, which are related to the antibiotic treatment. The first is a dysbiosis in the gut. That is, antibiotics kill off bacteria, normal bacteria. They allow the growth of undesirable organisms, including yeast. And I've seen a lot of patients who, after they've been adequately treated for Lyme disease, have persisting symptoms that require anti-yeast therapies or antifungal therapies in order to get their symptoms resolved. And then finally, or maybe not finally, but the other component is that antibiotics by themselves can produce damage to the mitochondria in the cells. This research is going on at MIT and Tufts University.
We've seen this, I think, with the tetracyclines and erythromycin and, you know, several of the...
It can happen. Well, here's the thing about mitochondria, which are the powerhouses inside your cells. Mitochondria probably started out as bacteria. They are what are, from an evolutionary perspective, they're called endosymbionts. And they're bacteria that produce ATP. And because that ATP is good for mammals, they found a safe haven inside the cells of mammals. And, you know, and they have their own DNA. It's transmitted solely by the mother, which is quite consistent with that theory, or maybe even the origins of that theory. So anything that kills bacteria can potentially damage mitochondria.
Interesting.
And the researchers at MIT have found that it's the tetracyclines are less likely to do it, because tetracyclines are what are called bacteriostatic antibiotics. They at the usual concentrations that are used, they don't really kill bacteria. They prevent them from growing, which then allows your gives your immune system a better shot at destroying them. But the penicillins and the cephalosporins and the quinolones and the macrolides, all these other widely used bacteria, are what are called bactericidal. They kill bacteria, and they are capable of damaging mitochondria. So there are some people with persistent fatigue or neurologic symptoms after the treatment of Lyme disease in whom mitochondrial damage may be the source of their problems. So we've just outlined about, six different possible reasons why a person who's just been treated for Lyme disease may have a persistent illness.
But, you know, when you what you just described, it's about 50-50 the consequence of the Lyme or other infecting organisms versus the treatment itself. So this poses an even greater dilemma, which is when you see patients, and you've probably seen patients who've been heavily treated, when do you hold and when do you fold? When do you start repairing them and when do you stay aggressive and keep treating them? I guess that's really the crux of it.
Yeah, it really takes a lot of clinical experience and judgment, I think, to make the right decisions. And it takes a lot of flexibility and listening to people, not just imposing a treatment on people.
There's no one-size-fits-all.
Absolutely not.
So what about some of these other co-infections? You know, say someone has been successfully treated for Lyme disease, but fortunately the treatment did not access their other co-infections. What about that?
Yeah, well, that's an important factor, and it fits into the persistent infection module, so to speak. The persistent infection could be a persistent Lyme or Borrelia infection, or it could be an ongoing infection with another organism. Deer ticks carry several types of infectious organisms in addition to Borrelia, which are the type of bacteria that cause Lyme disease. Probably the best known is Babesia, which actually is a parasite. It's roughly related to malaria and is not killed by antibiotics, not very well killed by antibiotics, and can produce a chronic infection that impairs immunity, causes fatigue, interferes with circulation and health, and hence brain function. There's Ehrlichia. Ehrlichia is a type of bacteria. Ehrlichia and Anaplasma are related bacteria that are in the category of bacteria called Rickettsia, Rocky Mountain spotted fever is another rickettsial infection. Now, in my experience, it's very unusual for them to cause chronic infection. They usually produce an acute infection. It can make you very sick, responds well to tetracyclines. I don't think I've ever seen anybody whom I really believed had a chronic Ehrlichia or anaplasma.
So, in other words, once you get treated for Lyme, it's likely that you'll get a twofer.
Yeah.
You'll get a twofer. You'll eradicate the Ehrlichia.
Except that there is a study, there are a couple of studies that showed that people who had Ehrlichiosis and then got Lyme disease were immune suppressed by the Ehrlichiosis. So they're not going to respond as well to treatment. And then there's a type of organism called Bartonella. Now, Bartonella is best known as the cause of cat scratch fever. It's an intracellular bacteria, and it can really be a devilish infection to treat. It can be chronic. It can be resistant to most antibiotics. The fact that an antibiotic kills it in the test tube doesn't mean it's going to kill it in a person's body or in an animal's body. And it may be spread by insects other than deer ticks. Bartonella infections can be spread by lice, for example, and other kinds of insects. They're very common in homeless people, for example.
Hmm.
And there's a wide range of symptoms that can be caused by Bartonella because there are different kinds of Bartonella organisms. And the CDC doesn't even recognize Bartonella as a tick-borne infection. Yet a colleague of mine had deer ticks in New Jersey tested at a lab that does PCR testing and found that at least in New Jersey, deer ticks were more likely to be infected by Bartonella than by Borrelia, which is the Lyme organism.
Hmm. That's scary. And then there's babesiosis.
Yeah, so babesiosis is, can produce anything from an acute malaria-like illness, chills, fever, sweats, that in some cases may be self-limited. That is, it may just go away, or may go on to a chronic infection that can produce fatigue and disturbances in blood flow, maybe anemia, and the blood flow disturbances may affect brain function. So that problems with memory are not at all uncommon with chronic babesiosis.
It's not actually a bacteria. It's a protozoa.
It's a protozoa. It's a parasite.
Like malaria. Like malaria. Right.
Lives inside red blood cells, and it requires a distinct type of treatment. The good news, I'd say, about babesiosis is there's extensive experience with herbal treatments for malaria, because malaria has been known for thousands of years. And those herbs can work really well for babesia.
It's like artemisia, things like that.
Artemisia, EGCG from green tea has been shown to kill babesia in mice. Cryptolepis is a West African herb that I've had some very good results with. And then there are, there are about five different herbal types of approaches to the treatment of tick-borne infection that are widely used, and most of them will work pretty well for babesia.
Well, that's a whole interesting subject unto itself because, so far it sounds kind of grim. It sounds like, you've got to put yourself in the hands of an expert physician like yourself, a Lyme-literate physician, to get the right cocktail of antibiotics to address your condition. But in part two, since we divide these podcasts into two parts, in part two I'd like to consider whether there's a place for natural treatment or at least natural support for patients who are experiencing tick-borne illnesses. And I know that that's dear to your heart because you are a premier integrated practitioner. You don't just wield the prescription pad. So when we return, part two of our discussion with Dr. Leo Galland about Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.